Well, hello again. It's Stephen Bruce here with another of our research reviews provided courtesy of the Research Review Service, and this one produced by Dr. Jeff Muir. What have we got here? We've got a paper on chronic leg pain in athletes, which was written by a whole bunch of authors, the lead one being M.T. Burris. Only one of them gave any affiliations, which was to the Department of Orthopaedic Surgery at the University of Virginia in the US. And the paper itself was printed in the American Journal of Sports Medicine in 2015. So what do they have to say about chronic leg pain in athletes? Well, they start off with some background stuff. Chronic leg pain is a common complaint in athletes. It's often managed by rehab practitioners and by orthopaedic surgeons, and over 80% of athletes are likely to be seen at some point for such an issue, and properly diagnosing and managing these injuries is challenging, they say. Well, there's a revelation. They've even put a reference in to prove that point. They go on, many chronic leg conditions present with similar and overlapping symptomatology, resulting in great care being required to arrive at the correct diagnosis. Now, they've separated out the differential diagnoses for chronic leg pain. And these include medial tibial stress syndrome, chronic exertional compartment syndrome, stress fracture, popliteal artery entrapment syndrome, nerve entrapment, Achilles tightness and tendinopathy, deep vein thrombosis, and complex regional pain syndrome. And these represent, they say, the more common causes. In this review, the authors provide the background, the diagnosis and the management of each of those conditions, and where available, an additional focus on the outcomes of the prescribed treatment regimen. So how do they go about this? Well, like I said before, this is a review. It's not even a systematic review. It's just a clinical review of papers being produced by other people, and it's focused, therefore, primarily on clinical information. It's a broad overview of current diagnostic and treatment approaches using various sources, and these range from clinical reviews to systematic reviews and meta-analyses. There's no specific search strategy employed. Instead, it's just clinical information gathered from available sources and summarised for the clinician. Now, the authors looked first at medial tibial stress syndrome, what we normally call shin splints, which is the most common chronic lower leg injury, accounting for 5% of all athletic injuries, they tell us. And shin splints presents as an exercise-induced pain along the posterior and medial borders of the tibia, with an estimated incidence of up to 22% in runners and up to 35% in naval recruits. Well, they do love to look at military recruits in these research papers, don't they? I have to say, I wouldn't have thought that the naval recruits were typical of an athletic population at all. But then maybe as an ex-Marine, perhaps I'm biased in my assessment there. Anyway, moving on. How do you diagnose shin splints then? Well, the criteria, principal criteria, are pain along the posteromedial border of the tibia that occurs due to exercise, and pain which is reproduced by palpation of the posteromedial border of the tibia. So the pain is generally present over at least 5 consecutive centimetres of the anterior leg, while posteromedial bony pain is imperative for diagnosis. Imaging studies rarely provide useful diagnostic information, save for MRI or high-resolution CT scans in very difficult cases. Management is initially non-operative with a focus on rest, cryotherapy, compression, elevation, stretching, physical therapy and pneumatic leg bracing. Orthotics, alteration of training regimen and shockwave therapy have also been recommended for recalcitrant cases. Operative treatment is rare and it includes posterior fasciotomy in severe cases that remain unresponsive to conservative treatments. So next they turned to chronic exertional compartment syndrome, or just compartment syndrome for short. This presents as an exercise-induced anterior leg pain, the majority of which, about 95%, involves the anterior and lateral compartments. It generally affects young people, 20 to 24 years old, active patients, but it affects males and females equally. In terms of diagnosis, pain initially presents as a predictable pain that begins at the same time or distance or intensity during the workout, but it subsides with rest. The progression of symptoms can include pain on walking and/or at rest. Now, swelling and local tenderness could be present, along with the potential for dropped foot associated with dermatomal paresthesia. Measurement of intracompartmental pressure is considered the gold standard for definitive diagnosis. Imaging rarely contributes to diagnosis and is used more often for differential diagnostic purposes. So what do we do for compartment syndrome? What's the management plan for this? Non-operative management is unfortunately associated with a high failure rate due largely to the unwillingness of the patient to modify their activities or the often delayed diagnosis for the condition. Treatment options do include ice, non-steroidals, massage, stretching, ultrasound, shoe and gait modifications, although avoidance of the offending activity is the most effective treatment. The use of botulinum toxin has also been shown to induce transient improvements. Surgical release of the involved compartment is the last resort option for patients unresponsive to conservative care or unwilling to alter their activities. So now let's move on to stress fractures. Repetitive stress resulting in microtrauma to bony architecture can lead to stress fractures, and these occur most commonly in the tibia. The location of the fracture, however, can vary depending on the type of activity or the sport. How do we make a diagnosis? Well, the onset of pain is generally insidious, and not surprisingly, it's worsened by weight bearing and it's lessened by rest. There's tenderness on palpation commonly, but you may or may not see any swelling. Yeah, we're fond of using, aren't we, the vibration testing using the tuning fork or ultrasound, but it cannot be used definitively. But if you do get a positive result, it can be a very positive indicator of a stress fracture. Although you can diagnose this by physical exam and history in many cases, plain films are often sought just to confirm the diagnosis with bone scans or MRI used to assist and confirm in difficult cases. What do we do about it? Well, the treatment's generally non-operative and includes surprise supplies, rest and pain relief, but also modification of identifiable risk factors, which could be shoes, running surface, training regimens and so on. Weight bearing has to be limited for 2 to 6 weeks after the diagnosis, and then of course reintroduction of training should be gradual. And we need to think of it taking something between 8 and 16 weeks to get to full recovery after the non-weight-bearing period. Okay, so let's have a look at popliteal artery entrapment syndrome. Compression of the popliteal artery as it passes between the gastrocnemius heads can cause intermittent claudication. If this isn't treated, arterial stenosis can result in permanent vascular damage, with aneurysmal dilatation and thrombosis as possible consequences. In terms of diagnosis, the most common initial complaint is pain, with leg cramping on strenuous exercise and mild swelling often present. Diagnosis is made with the assistance of imaging, such as duplex ultrasound, arteriography, CT angiography, or MR angiography. In terms of management, the authors really have only considered surgical approaches, and where this is indicated, what they're looking at is a posterior or medial approach in order to carry out a myotomy of the affected head of the gastrocnemius. And they talk also about saphenous vein grafting of the popliteal artery, which is reserved for aneurysmal or embolic disease. So as far as they're concerned, there's not much of a role here for the physical therapist. So let's have a look at what they said about lower extremity nerve entrapment. Now, they reckon here that the initial presentation may well be masked by acute injuries. So you're only going to realise you've got a lower extremity nerve entrapment if the expected recovery time goes beyond what it should. Commonly, we're expecting that the saphenous, common fibula, superficial fibula and sural nerves might be implicated in this, and this could easily lead to leg pain in athletes, and the most common cause of injuries will be their athletic activity. How are we going to diagnose this? Well, once again, we're looking for activity-induced leg pain, which is worsened by continuing with the offending exercise, so not dissimilar to some of the other conditions. The pain is often located at the site of the compression, but of course the referral is going to follow the nerve's distribution. We can make this diagnosis with a physical examination. We can use percussion or compression testing to confirm it, but also nerve conduction studies or electromyography can be used to further that diagnosis as well. Imaging, of course, isn't much use for nerve pathologies, but it can be helpful in identifying soft tissue injury or other differentials. Fortunately for us physical therapists, initial management is non-operative and we're looking at modification of the offending activities again, and then physical therapy, including stretching and massage. Iontophoresis and nerve blocks are advocated by some authors, and decompression surgery to relieve the compressed nerve is sometimes indicated in patients who don't respond to that conservative care. Now, we've next got a section on Achilles tightness, and the authors tell us that Achilles tendon tightness is a common but less recognised cause of lower leg injury, which is something I think I personally would dispute. But anyway, it can result in posterior calf pain and tendinopathy. Overuse and lack of flexibility in athletes can lead to microtears and degenerative changes, and as the Achilles tendon is required to absorb up to 12.5 times the athlete's body weight during running activities, the potential impact, no pun intended, of Achilles injuries is significant. Looking at diagnosis, and bear in mind this paper has been written by doctors in an orthopaedic department, they say that a history of activity-induced pain localised to the posterior leg along the Achilles tendon and calf is indicative of tightness, although these symptoms may be vague and difficult to reproduce. They talk about the Silverskjold test, which measures ankle dorsiflexion with the knee first in 90 degrees of flexion, then in extension, which helps to determine whether the symptoms are related to gastrocnemius or a combination of gastrocnemius and soleus. But they point out that radiographs are generally not particularly useful in assisting with diagnosis here. Management, once again, here we come into our own, I think. Rest, physical therapy and stretching are very often successful in mild cases of Achilles tightness. Non-steroidals are often prescribed for pain control. And, of course, there's shoe modifications available for athletes with associated gait or foot abnormalities. Surgical lengthening of the gastrocnemius soleus complex or of the Achilles tendon itself are, albeit as a last resort, options for chronic cases which haven't responded to conservative care. Right then, moving on, let's have a look at deep vein thrombosis. Now, we're told here that this is often viewed as a condition associated with a sedentary lifestyle, but DVT should also be a consideration for lower leg pain in athletes, especially given the serious consequences. Pulmonary embolism can occur in up to 50% of DVT patients, and 2% of sudden deaths in high school and college football, American football here, have also been linked to DVT. So, of course, exercise does give you some protection against the risk factors for DVT, and we're thinking here of Virchow's triad, which is venous stasis, endothelial damage and hypercoagulability, but high altitude training, endothelial damage from previous surgery and genetic mutations which can lead to hypercoagulability are present in athletic populations and they shouldn't be overlooked. Tough one to diagnose this one, I think. Physical examination findings can include unilateral swelling, local tenderness, extremity warmth, low-grade fever, and they mention Homan's sign, you know, that business with calf pain with forced dorsiflexion at the ankle. But it's only 30 to 72% specific for this diagnosis. Nevertheless, we shouldn't use it to exclude a diagnosis of DVT if we're worried. Duplex ultrasound, if you've got that in your clinic, that's the test of choice, and it's highly specific, something like 98%. Not much of a role here for us physical therapists, I'm afraid, in terms of management. Anticoagulants are the first line of treatment, and they've also got then to take into account when the athlete can get back on the pitch. Now, I guess here we could be involved in advising our patients, and the bottom line is they've got to finish their anticoagulant therapy, which has to go on for at least 3 months, and then a risk-benefit analysis is conducted afterwards about continued use. There's no real consensus regarding restriction of non-contact sports and so on, but historically a period of 7 to 10 days has been used. But there is a trend now towards early mobilisation with a gradual return to activities. Now, the last of the conditions that they looked at in this paper was complex regional pain syndrome, which, of course, is characterised by a disproportionate reaction to injury resulting in autonomic and motor symptoms with significant associated pain. And CRPS may or may not involve peripheral nerve injury. How do we diagnose it? Well, it's often a diagnosis of exclusion and generally follows a mild to moderate injury. And even when the extremity appears to be largely normal, we might see a progression of pain, changes to skin colour and temperature, and allodynia or hyperalgesia. There's no gold standard diagnostic test for this, but EMG, thermography, sweat testing and nerve blocks can all provide useful information. What do we do about this? Non-operative, generally, with a focus on medications and goal-oriented physical therapy, including TENS, progressive weight-bearing, tactile sensitization and massage. And the review reports that there's no definitive role for chiropractic, and by that I would infer also osteopathic care in the case of CRPS. But then it wouldn't surprise me if that's because the authors don't really know what osteopaths and chiropractors get up to in their clinics. So what can we say about the quality of this study? Well, you know, like I said before, this is a clinical review and it's focused primarily on clinical information. So it's a discussion which is comprehensive and the presentation of the background and the diagnosis and treatment is logical and you may find that really helpful. But on the downside, this is not a systematic search. It's not a systematic review. We don't know what the inclusion-exclusion criteria were. And so we got a large amount of information, but no specific search strategies or other criteria. What can we take for this in terms of the application and conclusions for us in clinic? Well, I'm sorry to be a bit bland, but injuries to the lower leg share multiple commonalities. It's difficult to diagnose them in some cases, but each condition has a different treatment algorithm, and proper diagnosis is, of course, paramount to ensuring effective treatment. Surprise, surprise, a thorough examination is recommended, and imaging assistance should be sought where appropriate. If you manage them properly, the conditions have favourable outcomes, and we can get the athletes back onto play as quickly as possible. So there you are, that's chronic leg pain in athletes. I hope you found that useful or informative. Remember, you can download the paper from the website, and you will find there all the additional references to back up what was said.